Most of you have probably thought about biking to work, or biking to most places for that matter, instead of driving. You get a little workout done in your probably sedentary lifestyle, you help the environment, you don't pay for fuel during a global energy crisis, and well, frankly, you look cool. But you never actually got to doing it, or you did it a couple times and realized that it's not for you. Maybe it was too difficult, maybe you were burned out halfway through and had to take a taxi for the rest of the way, or that you showed up too sweaty for work. If you're still, however, interested in the idea, just not so much the problems, electric bikes are just the thing for you. And just why do I say that? Well, let's imagine you are biking to work and you find yourself burned out, or you get a bad cramp and you can't pedal the bike the rest of the way. So here are your options. You take a taxi and leave the bike, which is not really an option. You go back home hoping you were less than halfway to your destination, otherwise it would be even more difficult to do that. Or wait a good while till your energy level comes back up and miss work a little bit. None of these are elegant options, really. There is one, though. You have an electric bike, so you either don't even pedal at all for the rest of the way and just use the throttle on your electric bike, or you have the bike assist your pedaling so it's not as difficult and draining. You still get a workout done, but you're not drained completely afterwards. When he said 80% of the electronic kits are made in-house, it meant that pretty much the only thing that isn't being made here is the battery test kits and the LCDs they install on the bike handles that show you your current speed, wattage used by the motor, battery level, etc. And even that has a custom software. The 500, 750 and 1000 watt motors are made in-house and are installed in the way that you are seeing right now. Regular bikes from different brands and manufacturers are taken into the facilities and then they are prepped to have everything installed on them. There are lots of types for bikes, and for each bike with its purpose, they might use a different battery capacity and motor. For example, they use a 1000 watt motor and 64 cell battery on their biggest and baddest fat bike meant for rough off-road terrain, and a 500 watt motor and a 52 cell battery for their urban bikes that don't benefit too much from the extra horsepower. I mean, it's not actually horsepower, but you know what I mean. The process that goes behind turning mundane regular bikes that are great for a workout to one that is not as good for a workout but is a lot more convenient and a lot more capable of transporting you from one place to another. So first they need to cut some holes into the chassis, precision holes into these oftentimes aluminum chassis, to make room for the connections between the controller as well as the throttle on the handle and the battery pack. So once they have installed, now it's time for the electric motor, which is going to be installed on the rim. So they take the rim off, they disassemble all of the spokes on the rim, they reinstall it on the electric motor, but there's a crucial step here. They need to make sure that the screws of the spokes that are connected to the rim as well as the electric motor are completely balanced so that the rim doesn't skew to one side or the other. So they spin it to make sure it doesn't touch two screws on both sides. If it does touch it and there's friction, they need to re-tighten or re-loosen some of the screws to make sure it's completely balanced. And now, which is designed for the 500 watt electric motor, this is the entire system with the battery pack installed and the controller also attached, as well as the throttle. But there's also another cool thing about this particular display and this whole system, but I'll reserve that for just a few minutes after we talk to one of the people behind this project to give us a little bit more information.
As an engineer and environmental enthusiast, I've always looked for a product to simultaneously save the health of the people and save the environment. And that's why I started a company called EVTech to manufacture electric bicycles in Iran. Currently, we are the largest e-bike manufacturer in Iran, and our bikes are tailor-made to Iranian trains. And people can use them here in our mountainous cities like Tehran easily. Our bikes are ranging from fat bikes, mountain bikes, and city bikes, and have different motors with different output powers. So you can choose from our products based on your need and your applications. At the core, we are a company that mainly manufactures power electronic components of e-bikes and electric motorcycles. We are manufacturing power electronics chargers, power electronic e-bike controllers, and also design brushless DC motors that have been used in our products and electric motors that manufactured by other companies. We also manufacture our battery packs and use very, very sophisticated battery management systems to ensure that our batteries are working in their ideal conditions and are safe to use in everyday basis.
The last bit of information that I said I'd be talking about before. So the bike has its regular set of gears. You got the back gears and the front gears, but then there's display and with this number that shows a assistive gear, let's call it. So when the number is on zero, when you pedal for like one round, it doesn't assist you at all. But as the number goes up, it assists you more and more. So if you pedal the same amount and the number is on like three, it pushes you a lot further than if this number was set to zero. This is great for those times when you feel like you're really burned out and you can't pedal that much, especially when you're in an upward slope. So you increase this number, you get more assistance from the electric motor to push yourself forward a lot more. Now it's time for me to take it for a quick little spin. So this throttle is the difference between enjoying bike riding and not so much enjoying it and looking at it as a chore and just a workout. I have been like one of the people that I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the type that wants to bike to more places but doesn't do it because I find myself burned out too quickly when I'm going up a slope. With this, I can enjoy the flat surfaces and the downward slopes in biking, which are a lot more enjoyable than the upward slopes, and just skip the difficult slopes. So I'm seriously considering getting one of these electric bikes myself. And with that, we have come to the end of the program. Until next week.
What an awesome report, as always. Many thanks. Now, let's finish off the program with a look at some news and trends in this sector. As we mentioned, there is a trend of adding value to items to increase their uses and profits. And Iran's nanotech industry is paving the way for a variety of added value products, particularly in the plastics industry.
Iran's Nanotechnology Innovation Council estimates that roughly 800 kinds of Iranian-made nanotech products are in the domestic market. One of these is the development of biodegradable plastic bags through nanotech research. Iran's advanced products in this sector are sent to nearly 50 countries worldwide. Last year, these exports generated over $700 million. Iran is among the top five countries in nanoscience production and scientific achievements in this field.
Plastics are a vital component in Iran's medical device production as well, and this sector is seriously booming with new products each year that help save people's lives.
Last year, Iran produced thousands of medical devices, which it exported to 56 countries worldwide. Iran generally holds a 1% share of the global medical equipment market. Moreover, the Ministry of Health says Iran's stake is worth over $500 billion. That's 200 times more than its value in 2018, demonstrating how fast this sector is growing.
Speaking of plastic, one cannot overlook the harmful impact its waste has on the environment. It's terrible. And plastic bags have the most amount of waste, both domestically and worldwide.
Iran produces some 490 tons of plastic waste each day, and one-third of this is from plastic bags. While Iran recycles a lot of its plastic, controlling this waste is still an uphill battle considering production and consumer practices. Therefore, Iran's Environmental Protection Agency has embarked on detailing more regulations for reducing the use of plastic bags. The draft regulations include replacing plastic bags with biodegradable versions and creating production standards for environmentally compatible plastics. Most importantly, the draft addresses ways to reduce plastic bag use altogether.
Well, that covers today's bazaar. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
History of knowledge in Iran. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with the fifth episode of the series in which we make you familiar with a few Iranian scientists to whom mankind is indebted in various fields of sciences. If you remember, we talked briefly on Abu Rayhan Biruni, the great genius of various fields. Today, we will make you familiar with the great Iranian mathematician, Khayyam, who is more known in the West for his poems. Stay tuned, please. Ghiyas-ed-Din Abulfat Umar ibn Ibrahim Khayyam Nishaburi was a great mathematician, astronomer, and poet of the Seljuk era, 11th century AD. Khayyam was born in Nishabur. He learned jurisprudence in his middle age with Imam Muwaffaq Nishaburi. He also learned hadith, exegesis of Quran, philosophy, and astronomy. Some researchers believe that he had studied philosophy directly in Greek. Khayyam is believed to have died in 502 to 505 AH, early 12th century AD, in his hometown. Some maintain that he was a student of Abu Ali Sina, but it seems unlikely since there is a great time span between the two. Khayyam calls Abu Ali Sina as his teacher, but this might have been spiritual. George Sarton writes on Khayyam, "Khayyam is the first to embark on orderly scientific research about various kinds of equations, categorizing them in an admirable way. His thesis on algebra introduces an orderly scientific thought and is probably the most outstanding work of the Middle Ages in his science. One of Khayyam's works in math is his thesis about Euclid's geometry. The only version of this book remains in Leiden Library of Netherlands. In this book, Khayyam has cast doubt on the principles of Euclidean geometry, which had been the textbook across the world for hundreds of years. 700 years later, Khayyam's method was chosen as the basis of studies by Russian mathematician Nikolai Lobachevsky in non-Euclidean geometry. German scientist Albert Einstein also benefited from the method shortly after. Another book of Khayyam, which is of great importance in math, is called Mushkilat al-Hisab, or Problems of Arithmetic. He claims in the book that he has discovered rules for expansion of a binomial theorem. Due to his precedence to Isaac Newton, in many university books, these binomials are called Khayyam-Newton binomials. Moreover, Khayyam's endeavor in attaining of coefficients resulted in naming the arithmetic triangle of these coefficients as Khayyam's triangle. This triangle is known as Khayyam-Pascal triangle. The Iranian great scientist Khayyam studied music in a mathematical method too. He set up a musical relations between three numbers of A, B, and C. His findings were harmonious with the natural gait and were not much far from the modified gait of Bach. However, for sure, one of the greatest works of Khayyam was his studious effort on Iran's calendar system in the 5th century. To do this, he calculated the Earth's orbit around the sun up to 16 decimals. According to astronomers, Khayyam's calendar is the most precise calendar in the world and has been completed by him on March 6, 1079. Astronomers are of the opinion that the solar Hijri calendar is more accurate than the Gregorian one because there will be a problem in its accuracy in every 3,770 years, while this is every 3,330 years for the Gregorian calendar. In the 5th century AH, Khayyam decided to regulate the existing calendar with a number of astronomers. He was just 30 at that time, but he was well known as a great scientist. Thus, Jalali calendar was prepared by Khayyam to coordinate the common year with the natural and real year. According to this calendar, Nowruz falls exactly on the first of spring or the vernal equinox. Thus, all common seasons coincide with real seasons. The reason why in the Iranian calendar, spring and summer have 93 days, autumn has 90 days, and winter has 89 days is that the beginning of each common season exactly coincides with the beginning of the real season. Unlike the Gregorian calendar, which faces a difference of nearly 3 days in every 10,000 years with the real year, Jalali calendar's year is always coincident with the real year and will never fall behind it. For that reason, leap years are not fixed in this calendar and are determined on the basis of annual monitoring.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In an utter disregard for the public, the French Senate has voted in favor of President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular pension reforms plan, bringing the package one more step toward becoming a law. 195 members of the upper house of the French parliament voted for the legislation, with 112 against. That amid days-long nationwide protests against the move. The plan, which aims to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64, has drawn hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions, out to the streets or walk out from their jobs across France. The protests and rolling strikes have affected refineries, public transport, and garbage collections, with the aim to pressure the government to withdraw the plan. Macron has argued that the procedure is essential to ensure the pension system does not run out of money. His cabinet members have praised the reforms. In a tweet, Prime Minister Elizabeth Warren wrote, "It is a key step to make a reform happen that will guarantee the future of our pension system." Now that the Senate has adopted the bill, it will be reviewed by a joint committee of lower and upper house lawmakers. If approved, the plan will be put to vote in the country's National Assembly later this week. That's where the government needs a majority to sign the bill into law. If the government fails to assemble a majority, Prime Minister Warren could deploy a highly controversial constitutional tool known as Article 49(3) to push the legislation through without a vote. Elizabeth Warren has repeatedly said she wants to avoid resorting to the 49(3) procedure, but she might have no other option if there is a real risk of not having enough votes. The possibility of using Article 49(3) comes as many unionists have already warned President Macron against forcing the parliament by pushing the text through without a vote from MPs of the National Assembly. Secretary General of the French CFDT Union Laurent Berger says using 49(3) would be very dangerous, as it risks creating a great degree of bitterness. French unions have called for an 8th round of nationwide demonstrations on the day of voting to keep up the pressure on the government and the parliament. The opponents of the plan argue that it would penalize low-skilled workers who start their careers early while reducing their right to leisure and a long retirement at the end. Many appear ready to fight for a better work-life balance after years of being pushed to work harder. But for many others, raising the retirement age feels like the last straw. For some others, it is a red line. According to government figures, nearly 1.3 million people took to the streets Tuesday last week to vent their anger, making it the highest turnout since the start of the protest movement. The figure is indicative of the fact that the French are showing signs of burnout and a change in attitude towards the workplace. Jean Jaurès Foundation researchers found that although 60% of the French rated their job as really important in their lives in 1990, only 21% did so in October 2022. Moreover, 60% of the French say they would rather earn less and have more free time, which is itself a sign of frustration among the French public about the jobs they're working. If this trend continues to persist, no one would guess what economic repercussions will be waiting for the French society soon. From a different perspective, this frustration with the workplace clashes with the president, who pitched himself as a candidate at work. For Macron, however, there's a lot at stake. Failure to reform pensions would tarnish the rest of his second and final term and stop his reformist passion dead in his tracks. On the other hand, the growing discontent with the establishment would be something the government would not want to deal with ever. almost a decade since foreign-backed terrorists in Syria tried to pull the country into chaos, it seems an all-out war against Damascus has failed. That's according to the Secretary General of the Lebanese Resistance Movement, Hezbollah. In a meeting with a large group of influential figures from various Arab and Islamic countries, Said Hassan Nasrallah asserted that many Arab states intend to normalize ties with Syria, but the United States opposes such moves. The Hezbollah chief stressed that Syria's real enemy is the United States, which is going ahead with its war and blockade against Damascus. He argued that Syria has been targeted by a U.S.-led scheme over its rejection to subdue to Washington. He pointed out that Washington's sanction measures against Damascus are failing with the help of the people and Syria's regional allies. In the televised address, Nasrallah hailed Syria for lying in the heart of a powerful axis of resistance, noting that there is confidence that the Arab country would remain at the forefront of the struggle to stand against the West. Nasrallah stressed that Syria's resistance disrupted all equations throughout the entire region. The Hezbollah leader also tied the security of Syria to its neighboring countries, namely Lebanon. He said what happens in Syria and Palestine is reflected directly on the regional countries and has a strong impact on Lebanon in particular. The prominent figure said speaking about the present and future of Syria is like speaking about the present and future of Lebanon. He noted that if Daesh terrorists, who had seized large swathes of land in Syria and Iraq from 2014 to 2017, had remained in the region, it would have affected Lebanon as well. The comments by Hezbollah leader comes as many countries, especially those in the Arab world, are gradually turning towards Syria by normalizing relations with the Arab country. Countries like the United Arab Emirates, Jordan and Oman are among those who have recently restored their relations with Damascus. To add to the list is Tunisia, with President Rais Said announcing plans to fully restore ties with Syria, which was once cut off more than a decade ago. Needless to say that many of those countries join hand in hand with Western nations to sow division in Syria. They also helped the West impose an all-out economic sanction and blockade on Damascus. As Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad has numerously said, hegemonic countries had implemented straitjacketed agendas, invested in terrorism, and put economies in a stranglehold with no regard for international law. Miqdad brands what he calls smart sanctions as a form of collective punishment against the Syrian people who are deprived of access to food, fuel, medications, and other basic necessities. As part of sanctions, the Western world has left no stone unturned to isolate Syria. But to what extent has that scheme been successful? Since the crisis in 2011, Syria has favored dialogue even with the opposition to support national reconciliation and stability. Moreover, Damascus has facilitated the return of millions of refugees who once escaped a foreign-backed militancy from Syria. The Syrian government has also made all its efforts to rebuild the country after large swathes of its land were devastated by terrorist acts. From the military perspective, President Bashar al-Assad, with the support of Iran and Russia, has emerged victorious from the years-long conflict. That could especially be highlighted when the Syrian government managed to retake almost all the territory it lost to foreign-backed terrorists. All in all, what seems to be of high significance is the fact that Syria, with the help of its allies, is managing to stand firm against the West's threats. From partitioning the Arab country to plundering the country's oil, Syria is doing whatever it can to resist against the West. That's exactly what the Hezbollah leader termed as failure of the West and its war on Damascus.
Trilateral meetings in progress in the capital, Beijing. The participants: Saudi Arabia's National Security Advisor, Mossad bin Mohammed al-Aban; Iran's Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani; and Wang Yi, Director, Office of Foreign Affairs Commission, the Communist Party of China Central Committee. Then came the announcement. After 7 years, Iran and Saudi Arabia have resumed diplomatic ties. Meanwhile, Ali Shamkhani expressed willingness to continue constructive dialogue, fully implement their consensus, and enhance good neighborliness to jointly safeguard regional security.
At the end of the talks, we reached a decision to start a new chapter after 7 years of severed relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia, while considering the interests of the two countries, the security and well-being of the region, and preventing undue intervention from extra-regional forces, particularly from the West, and constant mischief by the Zionist regime in the region. We hope that this new chapter will compensate for the stagnation of relations over these last 7 years and also lead to stability and security in the region, as well as the improvement of the welfare of all its people.
Saudi Arabia was also positive in its assessment of what this deal means. When it comes to the agreement itself, this is what we know. Both have agreed to restore diplomatic relations. This will be followed up by the reopening of embassies and missions within a period not exceeding 2 months. Per protocol, this means the exchange of ambassadors. The two countries agreed to implement the Agreement on Security Cooperation signed on April 17, 2001, and the General Agreement reached on May 27, 1998, aimed at fostering ties in economic, commercial investment, technical, and scientific fields, to name a few. Since the announcement of the restoration of ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia, there's been a tidal wave of responses and reactions. The U.S. President Joe Biden's response was clearly off the mark. He said better relations between Israel and their Arab neighbors are better for everybody. As for Israel, the opposition has been quick to react and has slammed Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It said the restoration of diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran represents a failure of foreign policy by Israel's longest-serving Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. There's no doubt, however, that this is seen as a major defeat for the U.S. and its standing, especially when it comes to diplomacy. Mark Dubowitz, the chief executive of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, has said, "Lose, lose, lose for American interests." This agreement demonstrates the Saudis don't trust Washington to have their back. Iran sees opportunity to peel away U.S. allies to end international isolation. Although this may be a huge diplomatic victory for China, this is also a victory of Iranian policy when it came to Yemen and Saudi Arabia itself. Let's not forget, this was a face-saving deal for the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, since his Yemen policy was defeated due to the Ansarullah movement's dominance in Yemen. Saudi Arabia was also defeated in Syria when it backed Daesh terrorists with the help of his allies, like the U.S. Other issues leading to the severance of diplomatic ties included how Saudi Arabia executed prominent Shiite cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. Saudi Arabia was also responsible when it led Persian Gulf Arab monarchies to blacklist the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Saudi's past behavior shows that it cannot be a trustworthy partner until certain actions are taken when it comes to issues like Yemen, Palestine, and Syria, where it has played destructive roles. It remains to be seen whether this agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran to ensure the security of West Asia would translate into a decrease of the U.S. presence in the region to its eventual withdrawal completely.
France has been hit by yet another wave of mass strikes and protests. The row is about President Emmanuel Macron's controversial pension reforms. An estimated 1.28 million people have participated in the nationwide strike. The demonstrations were some of the biggest in decades. The nationwide strike have disrupted train services, shut schools, and halted fuel deliveries. Unions have stepped up their campaign to force a U-turn on a deeply unpopular policy. Workers from different sectors have walked out of their jobs and held demonstrations in Paris and other cities. Refineries have stopped fuel deliveries, most trains have come to a halt, and power production has decreased during the industrial action. Some scuffles have broken out on the sidelines, with some people throwing projectiles at police who responded with tear gas. Unions have threatened to freeze up the economy with work stoppages. Some unions have called for open-ended strikes in sectors from refineries and oil depots to electricity and gas facilities. This is the sixth time since the start of the year that unions called a nationwide day of strikes and demonstrations. The disruption is expected to be greater and last longer as rail unions call for rolling, open-ended strikes. This could affect all national trains as well as international routes. Trains to Germany and Spain came to a halt, and those to and from the United Kingdom and Belgium were reduced by a third. Some students have also blockaded faculties, and some schools closed as teachers staged a one-day strike.
I don't want to work until I'm 64. I say to myself, enough already. For the moment, there are only promises made, and we don't know when it's going to end. So it's better to fight now than to lose our gains. That's it.
People are fed up. People are exhausted. People see around them that there are plenty of colleagues who don't even make it to the current legal retirement age. So how can we expect them to make it to 64? And then, for us, it's 64. But for the years to come and our children, what age will it be? 66? I think the government hasn't taken everything into account.
The strikes and industrial actions are about President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular pension reforms. His government is planning to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64 and increase the number of years of work required to claim a full pension. The change will be gradual, increasing by 3 months per year from September until 2030. From 2027, workers will have to make social security contributions over 43 years rather than 42 in order to get full pensions. The government says the reforms would boost the employment rate among 60 to 64-year-olds. In France, the employment rate in this age category is just 33% compared with 61% in Germany and 69% in Sweden.
Precisely, it is the most precarious people who are going to suffer the most from the reform and who are going to serve two more years. It is scandalous. Mrs. Bourne has never been a cleaning lady. She has never been a social worker for handicapped kids. She has never done work where you have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to work with cut-off hours, to work on Saturday nights, on Sundays. She does not know at all. She doesn't know what the people and the population go through. So yes, it is scandalous.
Macron has vowed to go ahead with the bill. The reforms were at the heart of the President Emmanuel Macron's re-election campaign last year, but are proving deeply unpopular. His cabinet says the changes are essential to prevent the pension system from falling into deficit and younger people carrying the burden. Macron's centralist alliance has the most seats in the National Assembly, but lost its majority in legislative elections last year. Therefore, it needs to count on the support from the right to be able to pass the bill. Another option for the government would be to use a special constitutional power to force the bill through without a vote. This is a risky choice because such a decision would be highly unpopular.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, a second bank, the Signature Bank of New York, has been shuttered as authorities move to protect depositors. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. All clients of Silicon Valley Bank will have access to their funds from Monday at no cost to U.S. taxpayers, federal regulators announced as a second bank was shuttered. The Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, Federal Reserve Board Chairman, Jerome Powell, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's Chairman, Martin Gruenberg, released a joint statement on Sunday, 12th of March, outlining what they say are decisive actions to protect the U.S. economy and strengthen public confidence in the banking system. After receiving a recommendation from the boards of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the Federal Reserve and consulting with the President, U.S. Secretary Janet Yellen approved actions enabling the FDIC to complete its resolution of Silicon Valley Bank, Santa Clara, California, in a manner that fully protects all depositors, the statement says. Depositors will have access to all of their money starting Monday, 13th of March. No losses associated with the resolution of Silicon Valley Bank will be borne by the taxpayer. A similar systemic risk exception has also been put in place for Signature Bank of New York, which was shut down on Saturday by the state chartering authority. All depositors of this institution will be made whole. As with the resolution of the Silicon Valley Bank, no losses will be borne by the taxpayer. Shareholders and certain unsecured debt holders will not be protected. Senior management has also been removed. Any losses to the Deposit Insurance Fund to support uninsured depositors will be recovered by a special assessment on banks, as required by law. The Federal Reserve Board also said it will make additional funding available to eligible depository institutions to help assure banks have the ability to meet the needs of all their depositors. The U.S. banking system remains resilient and on a solid foundation in large part due to reforms that were made after the financial crisis that ensured better safeguards for the banking industry. These reforms, combined with today's actions, demonstrate our commitment to take the necessary steps to ensure that depositors' savings remain safe, the joint statement adds. The Silicon Valley Bank failed on Friday, 10th of March, as fearful depositors withdrew billions of dollars from the bank in a matter of hours, forcing regulators to urgently close the bank in the middle of the workday to stop the bank run. It's the second largest bank failure in U.S. history, behind the collapse of Washington Mutual at the height of the 2008 financial crisis. Silicon Valley Bank was the 16th largest bank in the United States, and its predominant clientele was technology startup companies, venture capital firms, and well-paid technology workers, as its name implies. The vast majority of the deposits at the bank were in business accounts, with balances significantly above the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's insured $250,000 limit. Its failure meant that more than $150 billion in deposits were to be locked up in receivership until the government stepped in late on Sunday. Some prominent Silicon Valley executives feared that if the government didn't step in, customers would make runs on other financial institutions. Stock prices plunged over the last few days at other banks that cater to technology companies, including the First Republic Bank and the PacWest Bank. Signature Bank specializes in providing banking services to law firms, from cash management services to escrow accounts for holding client money. Regulators in New York said the decision to close the bank came in light of market events, monitoring market trends, and collaborating closely with other state and federal regulators with the intention of protecting both consumers and the U.S. financial system. The U.S. newspaper The New York Post has also covered this story. The federal government on Sunday, 12th of March, announced the failure of a second bank with deep ties to the technology industry as regulators rushed to try to stem the losses caused by last week's collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. Manhattan-based Signature Bank, a key financial institution for the cryptocurrency industry, was shut down over a similar systemic risk exception, according to a joint statement from the heads of the U.S. Treasury, Federal Reserve, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank depositors will be made whole, but the bank's shareholders and unsecured debtors will not be protected, officials said. The U.S. Federal Reserve said it will create a new bank term funding program to offer depository institutions loans of up to 1 year, backed by U.S. Treasury securities and other assets to help the banks. The Fed said the steps they are taking will ensure that the U.S. banking system continues to perform its vital roles of protecting deposits and providing access to credit to households and businesses in a manner that promotes strong and sustainable economic growth. The California-based Silicon Valley Bank had $209 billion in assets when it failed on Friday, while Signature Bank had more than $110 billion in assets. Silicon Valley Bank was the second largest bank to collapse in U.S. history after Washington Mutual in 2008. Signature Bank was the third largest. President Biden, on Sunday, 12th of March, praised the feds for finding a prompt solution that ensures that taxpayer dollars are not put at risk. The American people and American businesses can have confidence that their bank deposits will be there when they need them, Biden said. But hedge funder Thomas Hayes of Great Hill Capital told the New York Post it only took 2 days of seeing regional banks crash to do the right thing. A technology insider added, regulators blew it badly in letting it get to this, but this was the best way to prevent contagion. A banking source in San Francisco, California, called the developments good for depositors, but it is more regulation and it moves us closer to nationalizing banking. Meanwhile, Signature Bank executives are calling wealthy clients, begging them to stay and telling them, your money is safe here, a source told the New York Post. I was ready to pull everything. Now I'm reconsidering. There's no promise anywhere else is safer, the source said. I'm still going to be pulling some money. We shouldn't have to even have that conversation. The government's extraordinary action came just hours after Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen publicly said the government wouldn't bail out Silicon Valley Bank, a favorite of technology startups focused on climate change, as well as California wineries. Appearing on CBS's Face the Nation program, Janet Yellen balked at the government rescue of the nation's 16th largest bank, as was done for hundreds of institutions back in 2008 over the subprime mortgage meltdown. During the financial crisis, there were investors and owners of systemic large banks that were bailed out, Janet Yellen said. And the reforms that have been put in place means that we're not going to do that again. Yellen also insisted that officials were concerned about depositors and are focused on trying to meet their needs. I've been working all weekend with our banking regulators to design appropriate policies to address this situation, Janet Yellen said. I can't really provide further details at this time. Yellen's subsequent statement with Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell and Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's Chairman Martin Gruenberg said taxpayers wouldn't have to cover any of the bank's losses, an apparent reference to the bank term funding program. Customers were widely expected to make a Monday morning run on Silicon Valley Bank and potentially on many other banks and financial institutions.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3rd, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. The ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Office and Police Training. These riots had been planned. If the incident with the young girl had not taken place, they have found another excuse to create insecurity and riots in the country. It is clearly the work of none other than the spy agencies and malicious foreign politicians. They are not just against the Islamic Republic, they are against Iran. The U.S. is against a strong Iran and against an independent Iran. The Islamic Republic is not the only issue they are fighting. Of course, they have a strong, deep animosity towards the Islamic Republic. There is no doubt about that. But even without the Islamic Republic, they are against an Iran that is strong. They are against an Iran that is independent. They like the Iran of the Pahlavi era, a milking cow that is submissive to their orders. They want a king in Iran who, for a simple decision, will have to ask the British ambassador or the U.S. ambassador what to do. How could the Iranian nation tolerate such a disgrace? This is what they are after. They are against Iran. So these are the aggressors. Control is in the hands of those behind the scenes. Therefore, the issue is not about the issue of hijab. It is not about the death of a young girl. This is not what this is about. Many Iranian women who do not observe the hijab perfectly are among the steadfast supporters of the Islamic Republic.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You can see them attend religious ceremonies and events supporting the revolution. That is not what this is about. It is about the Islamic Iran's independence, resistance, strength, and power. That is what this is about. I will say one or two more things and end this talk. The people who are creating corruption and damaging the streets are not all the same. Some of them are young people who take to the streets due to the influence of a program on the internet. They're energetic and emotional. The emotions cause them to come out. Even so, all of them together are a very small fraction compared to the Iranian nation and compared to the faithful, devoted youth of Islamic Iran. So among these people, there are some who take to the streets because of the emotions and excitement. That is an issue that can be fixed with a small punishment. That is, they can be awakened and shown where they are wrong. However, some of them are not like this. Some of them are the remainders of those who were struck down by the Islamic Republic, such as the MKO terrorists, the separatists, the remnants of the sinister Pahlavi regime, and the families of the loathed members of SAWAK. The Ministry of Intelligence's recent statement clarified some of these matters to a large extent. But there is much more to this. The judiciary must determine their punishment in proportion to how much they have participated in the destruction and damaging the security of the streets.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you.
Our intern today .ir/en. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ashavit, Gaza.
Jerusalem. Said Poraza.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Kabul.
Minister, Kashmir.
Ground quarters.
People in the Gaza front of the Red Cross office on Monday to mark this year's Palestine. The annual event pays tribute to Palestinians who injured during Israeli wars and aggressions. Palestinians suffer from permanent disabilities. Caused wounded Palestinians say Israel's crimes will continue to go unpunished. Team is under the protection of West.
Our end remind us of the criminal Zionist enemy who left the Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people started in 48 and continue to take place world, especially the Western countries, must the Israeli regime.
Teen war on Gaza, Israeli forces, thousands, including women and children, and more than 11,000. In May, over 2,200 Palestinians, 685 children, the wounded people in Gaza are also suffering from the aid, which has created a harsh humanitarian situation in the region.
The last years witnessed addition, which caused wounded people due to their severe injuries, and in the same time, the socio-economic conditions.
The Palestinians in the blockaded territory struggle to cope is due to a lack of specialized medical for their needs.
We are calling our community in order to exert the pressure first to stop its on the Palestinian people, also to end this, to let end the medical equipment and medicine to Gaza Strip in order to help these people for surgeries and medical treatments.
Medics say Israel's used additional weapons during its wars and aggression of civilians.